Morning, this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee will come to order. Today is Thursday, April 28th, 2022. The time is 8:03 a.m. Members currently present include Representative Drummond, Representative Prox, Representative McCarty, Representative McCabe, Co-Chair Shragi, and myself, Representative Hannon. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today our recording secretary is Lori Rowland, and Kelsey Riker is our LIO moderator. I'd like to thank them for helping us, helping the committee this morning. Today's agenda, we have two items. First, we will hear an introduction of Senate Bill 136, an act relating to firearms and other weapons restrictions offered by Senator Myers. Next, we will hear public testimony on House Bill 167, an act relating to specie as legal tender in the state and relating to borough and city sales and use taxes on specie by Representative McCabe. Senator Meyer and your staff, Michaela Anderson, please come to the table and give us an introduction on Senate Bill 136. And let me remind, because I did not last committee meeting, members to silence their phones. With that, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. For the record, Robert Myers, Senator for District B. Just the real brief overview of the concept of the bill. What we're trying to do is make sure that people's firearms rights are protected within Alaska in the event of a disaster declaration. We notice that people need their firearms during a disaster declaration for a number of reasons. It could be because food supply has been cut off and we use them for hunting. It could be because we're concerned about self-defense, a number of other reasons. And that's why we've introduced the bill. And with that, I'll turn it over to my Chief of Staff, Michaela Anderson.
Thank you. For the record, Michaela Anderson, Chief of Staff to Senator Myers. Due to desire, if I may, Chair?
Yes. Well, let me, again, I haven't had enough coffee. We are joined this morning. Representative Tilton is in the room with us, and she has companion legislation to yours. I'm sure she's not here for our pretty faces.
What?
Actually, okay. I see they are freshly shaved, and she's here for those pretty faces. Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you, members of the committee. Due to disaster declarations around the country, some states mandated complete or partial closures of gun stores, ammunition stores, or firing ranges, deeming them non-essential or life-sustaining. This threatens Second Amendment rights. And for reference, we are going to the effects of the pandemic in 2020. But SB 136, the companion to HB 179, does not expand any Second Amendment rights, but rather clarifies the extent of the emergency authority granted during an emergency declaration regarding Second Amendment to prevent infringements on that constitutional right to keep and bear arms. This bill clarifies that a disaster declaration may not forbid possession, use, transfer of a firearm, firearm accessory, ammunition, or other weapon for personal use. It also establishes that closure or limitations on commerce must be applied equally across the board. So if we're going to close any of those aforementioned stores or buildings, we would also have to close, say, a grocery store as well. If you cannot own a firearm legally, you still cannot own a firearm legally under this bill. That is explicit on page 2. But furthermore, in January, a 3-panel judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ruled that Los Angeles County violated Second Amendment rights when it ordered gun stores and shooting ranges to close in 2020 in response to the pandemic. A question might be, why is this relevant? We're not out of the weeds with the pandemic, but we're getting there. And it's kind of like looking for a job when you still have a job. We want to protect ourselves from future lawsuits and make sure that it is explicit, especially since there's that Ninth Circuit ruling. If I may, I have a brief overview of the sectional,
please.
All right. Section 1A lists that a state or municipality may not impose various restrictions on Second Amendment rights. Section 1B clarifies that the section does not apply to a person who is not legally allowed to exercise Second Amendment rights. Section 1C establishes that a person or organization may bring civil action to superior court if they are adversely affected by an imposition of their Second Amendment rights. Section 1D states that the plaintiff under the previous subsection may recover attorney fees and court costs, and Section 2 repeals the definition of firearm accessory as it was moved above to definitions. If there are any questions, I believe we also have a representative from the NRA on the line for more technicals.
And we're going to stick with just an overview from your office today, and then at a future meeting, we'll take invited testimony and public testimony. Yeah. Members of the committee, for the sponsor or staff?
Is there more of a presentation?
Is that the entirety of the
presentation? That is our presentation.
Okay. Representative McCarty.
So you said you have someone from the NRA on the line?
If there are questions more difficult than I can answer.
Okay. So through the chair, so this is not just a proactive piece, although there's proactivity to it. There's actual application for the need of it because of what happened in California, and who knows what the future piece is. So it's seeing some relevancy for the need of this, as well as the proactivity because of that scene dynamic that's happened. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, that is correct.
Okay. And
follow up,
is there dynamics being seen elsewhere in the country where things like this is happening? It's not just a Ventura County's LA type of situation, but we're seeing this elsewhere too. That brings up great concern as well.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, it has been seen in other areas of the country. I don't have a full list of all of the counties and municipalities that tried to impose restrictions on Second Amendment rights through the pandemic. It never happened, but there was rumblings in Alaska as well, in our largest municipality.
The follow-up, so is there...
Follow-up?
Can we get some additional insight to how these rumblings or how extensive this has been throughout the country? Is there someone that could testify to that?
Well, we will have, if we hear of it, today's hearing was to hear from the sponsor and staff an overview of the bill.
Oh, I thought there was someone from the NRA that was able to be addressing that.
I would view them as invited testimony, and I thought we'd made clear. I'm going to brief at ease. So I'm going to differentiate and ask members if you have a specific question that the sponsor believes they're crafting. So I'm hearing that it crafted by someone else, the impetus for the legislation. But we had not noticed it for either invited nor public testimony today. So I want to be careful that we are not violating that, because we have not noticed it for even invited testimony, but response to questions that they would need to address. Okay, so Representative McCarty.
Okay, so thank you through the chair. The question that I have is, as we look at different things that come before us, is what's the problem? Is there a problem, or are we just creating a what if three comets hit the earth and what are we going to do? Well, that's a what if. Question that exists is what is. And in this question of what is to define or give some greater definition of what is the concern and relevancy for this bill. And it's not just a proactive for the comments, but it's that of something that's relevant to the future.
Through the chair, Representative McCarty, I will try to compile a list of examples and get that to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And maybe I can help shed a little light. The true impetus for this type of legislation starts from Katrina, essentially when the mayor of New Orleans sent the police departments throughout New Orleans confiscating guns. That's what started everybody down this path, frankly. That's at the risk of ripping a Band-Aid off the wound. That's what started Oath Keepers, was that sort of deal. And the initial thought was that if you are a cop, you will keep your oath, which is to protect the Second Amendment, to defend the Constitution, right? That was the sort of the genesis of it. But that's where this all started. And many states have done this, so I don't know if that answers your question, but it's kind of the genesis of all of this. And people saw COVID as, with the shutdown of the gun stores, as creating the same sort of issue. So,
Representative Schrage.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. So I have similar questions to Representative McCarty. I mean, certainly I'm a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment and Alaskans' right to bear arms and be able to purchase those firearms and everything else. At the same time, I want to understand the impetus for us passing statutes that deal with this particular issue, because, you know, in the sponsor statement, it says the intent is to clarify the powers of municipalities during an emergency. And, you know, we've referenced a Ninth Circuit court case where, you know, the California laws were overturned. In some ways, I see that as clarification, and that we could, as a legislature, decide that every time there's a court ruling that clarifies powers, we could pass a statute that kind of reaffirms and puts it into the statute books that, yes, these are the, this is the exact scope of powers. But I don't think that's necessarily good policy. I mean, we have a system that uses the courts, the executive, and the legislature to be able to create a framework for government and those powers and those restrictions. So I want to understand better what problem we're solving by putting this language in statute, as opposed to being able to rely on court precedent, which is well established and always building, that I think has affirmed that Americans, not just Alaskans, have that right. So that's something that I'm going to want answered before I'm comfortable with the legislation. I mean, I support the intent, I think, but I want to understand that issue that we're solving better first before we just go and put things into statute. The second question I have is related to, you know, I'm reading the text of the bill, and it says, you know, during a disaster emergency declared under AS, yada, yada, you know, cannot proclaim or regulate an ordinance or policy forbidding the possession, use, transfer of firearm accessory, et cetera. We already have laws that restrict the possession or sale of firearms. There's rules that are put around that to protect us, and would this bill, if passed, prevent any changes to those limitations? If a new issue comes up, if we're under a disaster declaration, are we then unable to amend or put in place rules that deal with an emerging situation? To what extent does this kind of tie our hands behind the back? And I don't know if you're prepared to answer that today, or love to hear a response to that. Thank you.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Schrage. So the way that this bill is crafted, it doesn't stop the normal legislative process with regards to firearms, whether it's at the legislative level or whether we're talking about at a borough assembly or city council across the state. What this is doing is saying that you can't use the disaster declaration power through the executive branch of a single individual to change those laws, to change those rules at whim. What we're saying is the deliberative process that we see here in this building, or that we would see at an assembly building across the state, nothing has changed there. What we're looking at is simply saying this is a limit on the disaster power of a governor or a mayor, saying that this is one you can't do on your own. You still need to go through the legislative process.
And another follow-up, if I may, just really quickly. So did this happen in Alaska? I think I've heard conflicting answers, not in committee today, but in talking to others outside of the today's committee meeting. I've kind of heard conflicting answers on this, and I'd like to hear from the bill sponsor whether or not you feel that this happened in Alaska, and if so, where, and can you just talk about that? Thank you.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Schrage. So what we have seen in Alaska was in Anchorage. They did not go nearly as far as what we spoke about in California or in other places across the country. What we saw instead was the municipality of Anchorage put out some rules about what stores could stay open, what stores could not stay open. And the end result of that was that larger stores, such as, say, a Sportsman's Warehouse, generally were allowed to stay open. Smaller stores, generally mom and pop, generally more specialty stores, were often under pressure to close. And there were a number of rules put out, such as square footage rules, how much of your store is dedicated to firearms, things like this. And it really put a significant burden of proof on those smaller stores. And we had one store that we spoke to that said that they were concerned because they had people calling the municipality trying to report on what they were doing. And every time the municipality showed up, they were complying with the rules. But effectively what this bill does is it flips the burden of proof. It doesn't change those rules necessarily, but it flips the burden of proof from the store to the municipality. And so it's changing the atmosphere in a lot of ways.
Anything else? All right. We will set this bill aside and transition to our next bill, where we do have public testimony noticed.
All righty, then.
Thank you for your joining us this morning. We'll take a brief at ease.
Thank you.
We're back. Next up, we have House Bill 167 by Representative McCabe. And if you would like to make any open remarks before we turn to public testimony.
Certainly. Good morning, Co-Chairs Hannon and Chiragi, members of the House CRA Committee. Thanks for the second hearing, or the public testimony hearing on HB 167. For the record, I'm Kevin McCabe, Representative for House District 8, and I offered this bill for a constituent, frankly, and I think it's a good idea. I've done a lot of research. It's been a real fun bill, and I have dozens of letters of support and not too many letters. In fact, I have no letters that don't support it. And one of the things I'm interested in will be the public testimony, because I think we need to hear from the public on this, both pro and con, and I think it's rather important. So hopefully there are enough people. I've certainly advertised it, and I'd love to hear others. I want to read one thing. Over the past, if you don't mind,
your presentation.
Co-Chair Hannon, over the past century, hundreds of fiat currencies have had their values wiped out. For this reason, many people hold some gold and silver, but it may be difficult to spend the theoretical 1 ounce of gold on a loaf of bread or a tank, well, maybe not a tank of gas nowadays, but a loaf of bread or something small, because the vendor or the merchant may not have enough cash to give you change for your $1 gold or your 1 ounce gold piece, which is almost $2,000 an ounce right now. So this fiat currency and using it as currency will allow you, if the vendor or the merchant accepts it, to spend the money in smaller increments. And it does contain gold. You all have seen examples. And so it meets the constitutional requirements for the state to use it. I also think there's some value to the state going forward to building up their own gold backs and having our own design on them and that sort of stuff, but that's a kind of a discussion for another time. First, we need to get this passed, and then we can see about the state building it up and having a state of Alaska gold back, which is would be the ultimate goal eventually, and I'm sure it will take a while. But so with that, I'm available for any questions, and I'm looking forward to public testimony. Hopefully there's dozens of people online.
Right now, so I'm going to put on the record that Representative Pukatuk joined us at 8:22, and then I'm going to open public testimony with a gavel. Public testimony on House Bill 167 is now open, and I'm going to turn to Ms. Riker, where we are not showing anyone online to testify, and I'm not sure if your staff in the room was...
Testifying publicly.
She's shaking her head no.
Okay.
Our culture silences.
I think it has to do with the 8 a.m. CRA
meeting. Doesn't help.
Okay. Okay. Seeing no one online, I'm going to close public testimony. And say Mr. Prox's constituents, he's told them 8 a.m. too early. I think he was the best vote on.
Yes.
Right. Do you have any closing comments?
No, I just appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward. And if the committee members have any questions, or even if you have constituents that have questions, my staff and I have been way into the research on this, and it's really interesting, actually. And I'm happy to answer any questions or direct them to Mr. Cortez that testified. That guy's a fount of knowledge. So I'm happy to answer those either now or in the future.
Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, just a simple question. I know that the specie doesn't have a denomination to it because the gold will fluctuate in value. So if legal tender to hand you the specie, is there some mechanism of you being able to go online or whatever to see the value of that specie at that time, the transaction?
Sure. There's a number of websites online that will tell you what the spot price of gold is, the ask price, and the sell price. And typically it's a negotiated thing as well with the vendor. It's sort of no different from trading dollars in for yuan in you know, the hotel that does that typically takes a premium, you know, when you change money in a foreign country. There's a little bit of a premium. I can envision a time when a vendor may do that and say, well, if you want to do gold backs, I'll need an extra 0.5% or something, or the spot price is $2,001 and I'll need $2,001 in 20 cents or something like that. And it's a little bit more of a free for all, a little bit more of a barter. But when you think about it, your dollar might not be worth exactly a dollar today that it was yesterday. So it's all, it sort of bypasses the fiat currency and the, sort of nebulous, we think of a dollar as a dollar, but it fluctuates greatly during the day. If you're really reading it, this does the same. So does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
Representative Shragi.
Yeah, I'm going to apologize to the committee for bringing accounting into the discussion at 8:30 in the morning, but I've had a nagging question with my little bit of an accounting background. So talking about the fluctuating value of assets. So if I have $1,000 today, 10 years from now, that $1,000 is still $1,000. It might not have the spending power that it has today, but it's still $1,000 thanks to our monetary system and the way that works. By go and I put that $1,000 into stock. I buy stock today, and 10 years later, that value increases, and I sell it. I got to pay taxes on those gains, right? What happens if I take my $1,000 and I buy a bunch of gold or gold backs or other specie? 10 years from now, the value of that gold has increased significantly. Am I required to pay taxes on that? How do I report that? And then to complicate things just a little further, let's say I'm doing this, I'm buying gold, selling gold, buying gold, selling gold. How do I track my gains on the value of that gold? Because let's say some of that I've just held for a decade and it's increased in value. How do I keep track of that, either as an individual or as a business? Am I going to run into problems with the IRS? It's just, I know it's a really big question to throw at you again at 8:30 in the morning, but it's just, every time I think about this bill, I think it's a really cool idea, but I have this nagging accounting, just concern, confusion, and I don't know if you can address any of that now or if you've looked into that. I know you've done a lot of research, but if you could help me understand better, that would be greatly appreciated.
Sure. It might not be through the chair, Representative McCabe from District 8 again. I remember to do that. So you should be familiar with the term basis, right? Yeah. So you buy something or you get something and when you sell it, supposedly you pay taxes on your gain from the basis. So I've been doing gold coins now and again through Oxford Assaying in Anchorage. You buy a gold coin and it's no big deal. You go in, you give them the money, you take the gold coin, you walk out. When you sell a gold coin to them, there's paperwork to fill out. How much did you pay for this? And that, I think, goes to the IRS, and you have to report how much you sold it to the sold it back to Oxford as a financial gain. So I suspect this will be the same. And that's about as deep as I know, just from my own personal experience, if that makes sense.
That's very helpful follow-up, if I may. So you have some experience doing this, it sounds like. So are you familiar with like FIFO, LIFO, last in, first out, first in, first out?
Right.
What are you required to do? Do you do that? How do you track that? I mean, do you have a ledger at home where you track every coin that you purchased and the price and which one you're selling? And
absolutely.
You do? Okay. Kudos to you, man. So I'm glad to hear that. It sounds like there is a process. Little worried that could become a complicated mess for a business that decides to do that, but I guess they do have the option to opt in to accepting gold as currency for conducting transactions. Don't know that I have a question that is well defined enough to articulate, but I'm just now my mind is going to, all right, you are incredibly honest and able to keep good records. I worry about, you know, the mom and pop shop that really loves gold and silver tender, but maybe doesn't have the business experience or isn't organized enough to keep track of all this, and just worried that, you know, they end up in a situation where the IRS is now auditing them and they're having to try to reconstruct all these gold and silver purchases. So not an articulated question. I don't know if you care to respond, but.
So remember that one of the reasons we're doing this bill is to prevent the taxation of this when it's used as legal tender, right? So you don't necessarily, when you hold on to a bill, say dollars were actually increasing instead of decreasing. So you get a $50 bill or $100 bill and you hold on to it, and tomorrow it's worth $102. You still have a $100 bill. You don't get taxed on the $2 that it's actually gone up. Or if you have a $100 bill and it's only worth $50 today, but it's worth $54 tomorrow in purchasing power, you don't get taxed on that $4 bill. That's what this bill is all about, is to allow it to be used as legal tender without taxation. So, I mean, the taxation question that we were talking about is sort of a nebulous out in the woods question, but this bill would prevent the when it's used as legal tender. When it's used as a collectible, like I do with gold coins, it's a different story. You know, it's no different than if you buy a painting as a collectible and it increases in value, you're taxed, or your obligation as a U.S. citizen, whether you're honest or not, is to report that to the IRS as a non-earned or unearned income. Whether people do or not, that's, I don't know that we can legislate that down to the point where everybody does it. I'm not sure.
Okay. I'll stop there because I know I saw some other hands go up.
Representative Prox.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. I think that we're dealing with the part of the bill that requires a study on how to figure these things out, because we have a real constitutional problem. We're thinking of the thing that was supposed to be established by the U.S. Constitution back in 1789. The intent was that gold and silver would be the medium of exchange for the whole country. And then the federal government went off of that. And the paper money was explicitly tried. It was the Continental Congress, I guess that's called what they called themselves, they explicitly wanted to ban paper money. And this legal tender is not provided for in the Constitution. And now we're thinking about it backwards. We're thinking about it in terms of these pieces of paper printed with no value at all, except what is established by the federal government, the number put on that, and the fact that people accept them, and they don't. But it is not, in fact, what was established by the Constitution. And it's worked because people have confidence in those pieces of paper. It doesn't work as well in other countries that are less powerful. I forget, you used an Asian country, but in Mexico, as an example, you can go to a bank or a hotel that does an overt exchange of pesos for dollars, and you pay a premium. You can also go down the street to the guy behind the dumpster and get a better deal. And that's what happens. And then in Mexico, it hasn't gotten completely out of hand, but in so many other countries, it's gotten completely out of hand, where it takes a billion, I don't know what it would be in some other country, I can't remember.
Rubles.
Rubles. It takes a billion rubles to buy a hamburger because they lost control. People lost confidence in the currency. Could have happened just recently with this conflict with Russia. They wanted to make ruble the international medium of exchange for oil and et cetera. And if the U.S. dollar loses its status as the international medium of exchange, then we will enter into the same hyperinflation situation that other countries have experienced. And that it would be great if we could participate, and it's going to have to be a straight state-driven effort, to reestablish gold or silver or specie as the medium of exchange. We have to start thinking about it different. An interesting exercise to illustrate the point is that in the, I think it's the 1828 Webster's Dictionary, a dollar is defined as a quantity of gold or silver, and I think it was, I can't remember, but anyway, it was a quantity of gold and silver. And now if you go to a dictionary and you ask, what's a dollar? It'll say it's 100 cents. Ah, good. What's 100 cents? It's a hundredth of a dollar. It's a circular definition, meaningless definition. We've bought it. We have bought into it. We shouldn't have. We will find out that was a mistake some point down. This bill is intended to start an effort to correct that mistake before we, as a whole society in the United States, run into a very big problem. But we can't define what that's going to be right now. That's what the study's all about. So we're initiating that study. And in the meantime, we're prohibiting municipalities from enforcing a sales tax on specie. So how does that work? In the case of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the city of Fairbanks does not charge a sales tax. And there, well, Oxford and there's another business, Alaska Rare Coins, sells gold and silver coins, and they're able to do that because they don't charge a tax.
in North Pole, they charge a sales tax, and nobody will ever open a coin shop or gold exchange in North Pole because of that tax. That's why I'm interested in this. Maybe we'll get somebody doing that. Juneau, you're not going to find Alaska rare coins in Juneau.
Well, actually, I'm going to correct you. We've had several gold sellers and coin buyers.
In Juneau?
In Juneau.
Good.
Yes. Because you can't drive to an adjoining, you know, I assume that in North Pole. So if I'm in North Pole and I don't like its sales tax structure, I drive 15 miles and I'm exited that jurisdiction. We don't have that. And our adjoining boroughs also charge sales tax here in Southeast.
Yes. And is there somebody that, can you buy a 100-ounce bar of gold in Juneau?
I don't know. I've never looked at 100 ounces. That's beyond my 20s in the parking lot. But I will. And much of our gold sales actually does come through our seasonal businesses. So they're not here year-round, but they operate seasonal. Many of them also sell jewelry, but they advertise that they sell gold bullion.
Bullion. Oh, okay.
So
I stand corrected.
I've never gone in. I'm not your – yeah. They're not businesses that I frequent, let alone gone in to see.
You're more of a diamond gal.
Not really much of a diamonds gal.
Right. Yeah.
I'm more of a put a down payment on that boat gal.
I see.
So I can't tell you, but over the course of the summer, those are things I guess I could frequent, some of those that advertise that they sell gold bullion as well as diamonds, emeralds, and Swiss watches. The emerald stores. I'll venture in and see what they sell.
Yeah, we'll have to form a task force.
So if I might, Co-Chair Hannon, once again, Kevin McCabe, District 8 representative, to put sort of a cap on this. If you sold goldbacks as a collectible, like we do some numismatic coins, mm-hmm. in Juneau, they would be taxable. So the jewelry stores and the collectible stores and that sort of stuff, say we as Alaskans decided to build our own goldbacks and put a picture of Denali on it, or, as I said, a future vision, and the gift shop down the street decided to sell those to tourists as a memento or something like that, then yes, it would be taxable. But if you're using it as a medium of exchange, is all this bill, without going into, petrodollars and rubles and all that stuff. However, once again, this is very interesting. If you look at history, the start of a decline of any of the great societies became when they took their currency off of a standard and made it strictly fiat currency. Once the confidence in the government starts to wane and the value of the currency starts to wane, Argentina is a great example of, you could bring wheelbarrows full of money to the store at one point to buy a loaf of bread. So this is a hedge against that, and I think it's a very important hedge that the state of Alaska needs to consider. Hence, I'm offering this. So,
Senator Schrag.
Ken, were you in the queue? Yeah, I think he was.
Okay.
You want to go to him?
Okay, Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair, and I just want to add to that and something that Representative Schrag brought up, just more security. In the case of using Representative Schrage's example of $5,000, and years later that $5,000 buys less, my question is, is the federal government going to reimburse us for the loss of the $5,000 value, but they're going to tax us for the greater? So it seems to have to go both ways. And by having this gold back, that you've got a standard that's there rather than something that's not. So that's my thought.
Sam Schrag.
So the reason I jumped in the queue is to ask a clarifying question on whether or not this would eliminate the need to report capital gains and be taxed on those, because I think we're eliminating the sales tax, but we're not eliminating the capital gains tax. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. If I might continue, I don't know that I have a articulated question here. I mean, I recognize the concern that's been outlined on not having something that the money is tied to, having a fiat currency. And I recognize the concerns in Argentina and any one of the many, many countries that is running into Turkey and all sorts of countries that are dealing with huge monetary issues. We're also a very different country in the United States, and there's tremendous benefit from not being on the gold standard. And while your money may devalue over time, as Representative McCarty outlined, the reason you don't get credit on your taxes for that loss in value is because that dollar, that cent, is a monetary unit. If you go into the definition, yes, it's not tied to gold, but it's a monetary unit as defined and valued by the government and all the controls and levers that they can pull. If you have losses on your car or you buy gold and you have a loss in value on that, it certainly is a business. You'd be able to take that as a loss and count that against your income and therefore not be taxed on it because you've had a loss that offsets that income. So all this is to say, I think, again, like the idea of removing the sales tax. I think we do. There are some big issues around taxation that we still have to work out, specifically around capital gains. And I don't know, just a lot to consider here. I like the bill, but my mind is not to a place. I've not been able to get to a place where I'm comfortable with it yet. And I'll look forward to working with you to get there. But fascinating discussion, really enjoying it, and I think we'll have to dig into this a little more.
Well, Representative McCabe, I have a question, and it goes to the last part in the study that's referenced, and directing the House Finance Committee, and I'm curious because I've not seen that anywhere previously when we've asked the legislature to do research. I've seen it asked of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee to evaluate or direct the audit. State auditor to do X or Y. So help me out with the study being run by the House Finance Committee and how you came up with that.
Well, that's a good question. I'm going to have to ask staff to come up and answer that because that was.
So Angela Steffel, staff to Rep. McCabe. That was from the Legal suggested that. It is part of other bills from other states. They have different departments and different committees that do that study. Here we thought it would be better that the legislature had control over that study, so we did it out of House Finance versus Treasury, if that makes sense.
Okay. And
So
I understand the difference versus Treasury because that was one, but within the legislature choosing House Finance versus, one, it's a singular committee on one side of a bipartisan when we do have a joint council that in general, the external contracts for researching if things have been run through. And so that's where I was.
That we can change that. It was just a suggestion from Legislature.
And through the chair, Representative McCabe, I don't think it was House Finance was just it came from Ledge Legal. It wasn't meant to exclude, say, Senate Finance or I think that we wanted enough control over this bill as it sort of morphed into something really tangible that we could have some studies done and some discussions and that sort of thing that we put that in there like that. But it wasn't meant to exclude Senate Finance, so it would certainly be a good amendment to put, Senate and House Finance Committees, or some sort of joint committee, or even some sort of study committee would be awesome.
Well, and like I said, we have two joint committees of the legislature that serve in the interim, the Legislative Council, which. This has nothing related to sort of the jurisdiction of that, but the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, which is a joint committee and has external powers for even subpoena and research and directing the legislative auditor to execute contracts. And so, in my whole 4 years here, not seen that. And so was trying to figure out just didn't know what, had never thought of telling House Finance what they would be doing. Generally, please do this has usually been mine. And so, and I'm sure the Senate is much more flexible in that approach.
Right.
Representative Proctor.
It's just common knowledge that the House has so much more credibility than the other body.
Oh, boy. I'll touch that.
Step back before the lightning strikes. Anything else? All right. I heard his gold pocket watch chain being jingled. All right. Any closing comments?
No, Co-Chair Hannon and Co-Chair Shragi and the committee, I just appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward to y'all. It's been an awesome learning experience for me personally, and I certainly appreciate your consideration for this. So.
Okay. I see no one else seeking time at the mics, and we have no further business to come before us today, so we're going to adjourn this meeting at 8:49 this morning.